Broadcasting from the campus of Henry Ford College, this is WHFR Dearborn. Listener-supported, non-commercial radio, featuring local and independent artists.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
We have a great economy. We're a very strong economy, but this blindsided the world. And I think we've handled it very, very well. I think they've done a great job. The people behind me have done a great job.
The coronavirus pandemic surges worldwide. The death toll has topped 4,000 with over 113,000 confirmed infections. Italy is now on nationwide lockdown.
There will not be any more Zone 1 or Zone 2 in the country. It will be Italy. Italy, a protected zone. All movement across the country is to be avoided unless motivated by three specific circumstances: reason of work, reasons of necessity, or health reasons.
We'll spend the hour on the response to the coronavirus around the world. We'll speak with epidemiologist Thomas Boyke with the Council on Foreign Relations and Dr. Alfredo Moravia, editor-in-chief of the American Journal of Public Health. We'll go to Italy to speak with a student in quarantine and ask about life in the red zone. And we'll talk to the Marshall Project reporter Kerry Blakinger about fighting the virus in prisons where key supplies like alcohol-based sanitizer are banned. We'll go to Washington State and talk to an undocumented immigrant organizer about demands to protect thousands in detention centers around the United States. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Coronavirus cases continue to surge worldwide. The death toll has topped 4,000 with over 113,000 confirmed infections. Italy is now on nationwide lockdown.
I am about to sign a decree that we can describe as I stay at home. There will not be any more Zone 1 or Zone 2 in the country. It will be Italy. Italy, a protected zone. All movement across the country is to be avoided unless motivated by three specific circumstances: reason of work, reasons of necessity, or health reasons. It is prohibited to gather in and outside bars open to the public.
That's Italian Prime Minister Giuseppe Conte. Around 60 million people in Italy are now under the restrictions. At least six prisoners in Italy have died as riots erupted across dozens of densely populated Italian prisons over restrictions imposed to contain coronavirus, including limits on family visits. In China, where cases continue to steadily decline, President Xi Jinping visited the quarantine city of Wuhan today, the epicenter of the pandemic, for the first time since the coronavirus was identified there. Here in the United States, a number of major universities have moved to online classes, including Ohio State, the University of Southern California, the University of Washington, Brown, Stanford, Columbia, and Barnard colleges. In Detroit, officials restored water service to thousands of households as fears spread of coronavirus reaching the city. Thousands of Detroit homes were without water because of unpaid bills. Florida Republican Congressmember Matt Gaetz announced via Twitter Monday he will self-quarantine after learning he'd had contact with an attendee at the Conservative Political Action Conference, or CPAC, who's been diagnosed with coronavirus. Gaetz reportedly received the news while aboard Air Force One with President Trump. Just last week, Gaetz appeared to mock the coronavirus outbreak, showing up in Congress wearing a gas mask as the House passed emergency funding to combat the disease. On Saturday, he announced a resident of his district had died from the disease. He's the latest Republican lawmaker to self-quarantine after attending CPAC last month. Georgia Congressmember Doug Collins is also in self-quarantine. Collins joined Trump on his visit to the Centers for Disease Control last week and shook Trump's hand. The White House says that President Trump has not taken a coronavirus test. Meanwhile, Wall Street suffered its worst day in more than a decade Monday, bringing losses in recent weeks to more than $5 trillion in stock market wealth. An oil price war between Saudi Arabia and Russia further compounded the stock market turmoil. We'll spend the entire hour on the coronavirus pandemic after headlines. Voters are headed to the polls and caucus sites today in six states, Michigan, Mississippi, Missouri, Idaho, North Dakota, and Washington. Voting also ends today in the Democrats abroad primary. A total of 352 delegates are up for grabs, with the biggest prize being Michigan, which will award 125 delegates. Bernie Sanders beat out Hillary Clinton in Michigan in 2016. Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer has backed Joe Biden, while Sanders has been campaigning in the state with Reverend Jesse Jackson following his endorsement. Sanders has called out Joe Biden's record on trade and his support for deals like NAFTA, which he says have cost Americans millions of well-paid jobs and hurt unions. This is Sanders speaking at a Detroit rally Friday.
Going to defeat Trump in Michigan, in Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin, it will be very hard for a candidate who voted for these disastrous trade agreements.
Senator Sanders also held a roundtable yesterday in Michigan on the coronavirus. The primaries have narrowed down to a race between Senator Bernie Sanders and Joe Biden after Senator Elizabeth Warren and billionaire Mike Bloomberg dropped out last week after disappointing Super Tuesday results. Hawaii Congressmember Tulsi Gabbard also remains on the ballot, though she's been locked out of next week's debate following a DNC rule change on the delegate count needed to qualify. Bloomberg has since endorsed Joe Biden, joining other former presidential candidates Pete Buttigieg and Senators Amy Klobuchar, Cory Booker and Kamala Harris. Senator Warren has yet to back either candidate. The Working Families Party Monday endorsed Bernie Sanders. The group, which initially endorsed Elizabeth Warren before she dropped out, wrote, quote, "Bernie Sanders has been a lifelong champion for working people. He wants to make health care, housing, child care and education basic rights, reform our criminal justice system, protect and expand Social Security, and take bold action on climate," unquote. The progressive group backed his candidacy in 2016. Meanwhile, Axios on HBO is reporting Joe Biden's inner circle has been discussing possible cabinet appointments if he wins the presidency. Contenders reportedly include Jamie Dimon, CEO of J.P. Morgan Chase, and Ann Finucane of Bank of America for Treasury Secretary, Mike Bloomberg for World Bank President, and Susan Rice, Obama's National Security Advisor, or John Kerry as Secretary of State. Pete Buttigieg may be considered as ambassador to the United Nations after he quickly moved to endorse Biden after suspending his own presidential campaign. The plan is being described as return to normal, as a counter to the tumultuous Trump administration. In more primary news, Dallas County is requesting a recount of last week's Super Tuesday votes after officials discovered a discrepancy between the number of voters who signed in and the number of ballots cast. Marches continued across Latin America Monday, one day after International Women's Day, to protest femicide and state repression and demand equal rights and reproductive freedom. In Mexico, tens of thousands of women withdrew from public life as part of a nationwide strike dubbed A Day Without Us. Organizers are drawing attention to the fact that 10 women in Mexico are killed every day, often by their domestic partners. Women across Chile also staged mass rallies and took part in a work stoppage as part of the strike effort. Similar actions took place in Argentina, where demonstrators called out violence against women and voiced their support for recent efforts to legalize abortion. This is Andrea Conde of the feminist organization Avanza.
Again, women, lesbians, and trans people go out to continue fighting for our rights in a very special year in Argentina, in a year where the president has just announced that he will present a project for legal and safe abortion. So this year has the very strong significance, and we are, as always, overflowing the streets of all the cities in this country. And this women's revolution does not only occur in Argentina, but it occurs everywhere in the world, and that's why it has the power it has.
In Afghanistan, U.S. troops troops have started their withdrawal as part of the U.S.-Taliban agreement as political turmoil deepens following dual inaugurations on Monday. Afghan President Ashraf Ghani and rival leader Abdullah Abdullah both held inaugural ceremonies interrupted briefly after explosions were heard, though no injuries have been reported. The fate of intra-Afghan talks due to kickoff today remains uncertain. The U.S. is calling for the U.N. Security Council to endorse its deal with the Taliban. Ceremonies are being held in Ethiopia and around the world today to mark 1 year since the crash of Ethiopian Airlines Flight 302, which killed all 157 people on board. A new House report released Friday finds engineering errors, inadequate federal safety oversight, and a, quote, culture of concealment were responsible for the crash, as well as Indonesia's Lion Air crash in October 2018, which killed 189 people, both crashes on Boeing 737 MAX aircraft. Ethiopian aviation authorities also released a report this week blaming Boeing equipment and training for the crash. In other aviation news, the trial of four people, three Russians and one Ukrainian, accused of downing Malaysia Airlines Flight 17 over eastern Ukraine in 2014, opened in the Netherlands Monday. The names of the 298 victims were read in court before proceedings began. A memorial tribute for Puerto Rican revolutionary Rafael Concel Miranda is planned in New York Thursday following his death last week. Rafael Concel Miranda was a hero in the Puerto Rican liberation movement and one-time member of the Puerto Rican Nationalist Party, but was labeled a terrorist by the U.S. government after he and three others shot up the U.S. Capitol March 1, 1954, to protest Puerto Rico's status as a U.S. colony. Miranda often referred to the attack as an armed demonstration. He was eventually released from prison by President Jimmy Carter in 1979. In the subsequent decades, Miranda continued to advocate for the independence of Puerto Rico. In 1990, he told the New York Times, quote, "If this is still a colony, why should I change?" Rafael Concel Miranda died at his home in San Juan, Puerto Rico, at the age of 89. And the 2020 Izzy Award for Outstanding Achievement in Independent Media will be shared between three recipients, journalist Matt Taibbi, the publication News Inside, and Puerto Rico's Center for Investigative Journalism. Longtime reporter Matt Taibbi has focused on media bias, government misconduct, and the presidential campaign, calling into question corporate and so-called liberal media coverage of politics. He's the author of the book Hate, Inc., and co-host of the Useful Idiots podcast. News Inside was launched by the Marshall Project in 2019 and provides reporting on criminal justice issues for prisoners with articles written by current and former prisoners. Puerto Rico's Center for Investigative Journalism published 900 pages of damning messages last year between then-Governor Ricardo Rosselló and other top-level officials, triggering a mass uprising that led to his resignation. The Izzy Award is presented by the Park Center for Independent Media at Ithaca College, named for the legendary dissident journalist I.F. Stone. You can see our interview with these members of the Center for Investigative Journalism, as well as our past interviews with Matt Taibbi, at our website, democracynow.org. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman.
And I'm Juan Gonzalez. Welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world. Today we spend the hour looking at the coronavirus pandemic that has now infected more than 113,000 people globally and killed more than 4,000. Italy is under a nationwide lockdown, with all 60 million residents now facing travel checks, school closures, and bans on public events. This comes as Chinese President Xi Jinping visited the virus epicenter of Wuhan for the first time since the outbreak. China recorded just 19 new cases of the virus over the previous 24 hours, the lowest update since it began reporting national figures. In the United States, officials report 26 deaths of people infected with coronavirus, most of them in Washington state. The number of confirmed cases in New York has grown to 143, making it the state with the largest number of confirmed cases.
Meanwhile, Wall Street suffered its worst day in more than a decade Monday. The Dow Jones Industrial Average fell more than 2,000 points, or nearly 8%, based largely on concern over the coronavirus and oil prices. This brings losses in recent weeks to more than $5 trillion in stock market wealth. President Donald Trump announced Monday he will take, quote, major steps to minimize the economic impact.
We are going to be asking tomorrow, we're seeing the Senate, we're going to be meeting with House Republicans, Mitch McConnell, everybody, and discussing a possible payroll tax cut or relief, very substantial relief. That's a big number. We're also going to be talking about hourly wage earners getting help so that they can be in a position where they're not going to ever miss a paycheck. We're going to be working with companies and small companies, large companies, a lot of companies, so that they don't get penalized for something that's not their fault. It's not their fault. It's not our country's fault. This was something that we were thrown into, and we're going to handle it, and we have been handling it.
This comes as five congressmen have self-quarantined, including Florida Republican Congressman Matt Gaetz, who announced on Twitter Monday he will self-quarantine after learning he had contact with an attendee at the Conservative Political Action Conference who has been diagnosed with coronavirus. Gaetz reportedly received the news while aboard Air Force One with Donald Trump. Just last week, he appeared to mock the coronavirus scare, showing up in Congress wearing a gas mask as the House passed emergency funding to combat the disease. Republican Congressman Doug Collins of Georgia also came in contact with the CPAC attendee, and at the end of February, Collins joined Trump on his visit to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention in Atlanta last week and shook his hand. Collins also is in self-quarantine. Gaetz and Collins joined lawmakers Senator Ted Cruz and Arizona Congressmember Paul Gosar in self-quarantine after interacting with the individual at the conference.
Meanwhile, more than 40 U.S. colleges have canceled in-person classes, including Columbia, Princeton, Rice University, Stanford, Hofstra, the University of Southern California, Ohio State, the University of Washington. Meanwhile, Detroit Mayor Mike Duggan announced Monday the city will restore service to thousands of households whose water was shut off. For more, we're joined by two guests. In Washington, D.C., Thomas Boyke is with us, director of the Global Health Program, senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations, author of the book Plagues and the Paradox of Progress, Why the World is Getting Healthier in Worrisome Ways. Here in New York, Dr. Alfredo Morabia is with us, professor of epidemiology at the Barry Commoner Center for Health and the Environment at Queens College, City University of New York, editor-in-chief of the American Journal of Public Health. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Thomas Boyke, let's begin with you. Why has the U.S. mismanaged this so severely at a time when time is of critical importance at the beginning of a pandemic? For example, the number of tests, the lack of testing that's available in this country compared to China, compared to South Korea. Can you explain what happened?
So on the testing side, it seems that what happened was is that our Center for Disease Control and Prevention developed a test in real time. That's great. In most of the former outbreaks we've seen, the CDC has led the world. They did so under emergency use authorization from the FDA. It became clear pretty quickly that there was something wrong with that test. We're still investigating what was the cause of that error. The challenge was, from the FDA perspective, when they started to get requests from state labs to make their own version of the test, the FDA refused to grant that authorization for 5 days. That's a little ironic because the Trump administration itself has been reluctant to regulate laboratory tests overall. It's really only during an emergency that FDA even has this role. So we were very slow to respond. The broader issue here, though, is that we're dealing with a
Health Organization had a test that the CDC rejected. Is that right? That everyone else is using.
That's right. So it was developed in Germany, adopted by the World Health Organization. As you said, most countries are using it. South Korea, as you pointed out, has done at least 190,000 of these tests. As of last week, we had just done a little under 2,000 tests, so we're greatly behind on that. But some of it really does seem to be, in the U.S. context, a focus on the threat from abroad as opposed to recognizing that, to some degree, the burglar was in the house, the pathogen was spreading domestically, and we had to shift tactics.
And I'd like to ask Dr. Alfredo Morabia, what about the status of the CDC? There have been numerous cutbacks in recent years to the CDC. Talk about its preparedness for this pandemic.
Yeah, the CDC budget has been cut for at least 12 years now. I mean, following the recession in 2008, I think that was the peak. And since then, it's been declining about 10%, I think. It's clear that the budget is not what it should be. It's clear that we don't have a healthcare system that is as good as it could be. But I think the problem, and this is what the journal has been raising and our authors have been writing, is that we have a social problem that is much more important and which makes us vulnerable for the progression of the epidemic. Because if people have access to care, have insurance, you know, we can manage this. We can slow down the progression. It's clear we have a pandemic, you know. We're going to have the epidemic curve. It's going to rise until, you know, enough people are infected. It's going to disappear when maybe 40 or 70% of the people are infected. So if it all occurs quickly, we are in trouble because our system is going to be overwhelmed. It's going to be a health crisis. We have to slow it down. We have to stretch it. And if people are insured, if people have access to care, we can deal with that, even with the limitation of the budget that CDC have had to endure over the last years. But the question is that the lack of access for poor people, you know, that have been increasing lately. I mean, the ACA, the Affordable Care Act, had reduced to 10% the proportion of people who are not covered with insurance in this country. It's up again, you know, 5%. The fact that people to have access to Medicaid have to work, you know, will push them to go to work, even if they are sick. The fact that immigrants who are undocumented are scared to go to get health care, get tested, treated, vaccine when we'll get it, you know.
And explain public charge, what President Trump has done.
This is about the risk of being deported for undocumented immigrants, but for the one that are legally here, the public charge rule, you know, says that if they use welfare, they cannot be admissible to get a green card.
Even though it's legal to use welfare.
Exactly. And so they won't be considered for green card. And so these immigrants are also deterred from using health care, from going and get a test to know whether they are infected, etc. So what does this create? It creates a zone of the country, large sector of the population in which the progression of the epidemic and the virus can go very fast, like wildfire. We cannot contain it there. And this is what makes us today very vulnerable. And I think this should be rescinded immediately. I mean, all those, the public charge rule, the fact that people have to work for Medicare, the attacks on the Affordable Care Act, and which the Supreme Court is going to look at very soon, all these issues needs to be changed in order to be able to...
Do you see it as Medicare or coronavirus for all?
That's a good way of saying it. In some ways, it's true. In some ways, it's true. And this is why European countries are better prepared than us. Universal access to health care is key for the protection of the whole population here.
Yeah, I wanted to ask Thomas Boyke, this whole issue of the federal government pursuing a strategy and various states pursuing more stringent strategies. You have Oregon, Washington, California, Maryland, New York declaring states of emergency, while from the White House we're getting this this message from President Trump that is quite different.
Yeah, so to some degree it's appropriate that states and localities tailor their response to what they're seeing at their communities. That's both what their legal authorities are, and that's what we should see from a medical and ethical standpoint. The challenge that we have is they're being undermined to some degree by the mixed messages that are coming out from the White House. This is an environment where it's really important to be clear to the public what the risks are, the importance of taking that threat seriously, and to adopting the good measures that one can have to reduce the spread of infection. And they're not getting that support from the White House. State and local officials need guidance on when they should be adopting social distancing policies, What are the criteria? What are the indicia they should be looking at? And by all reports, they're not getting it from the federal government. And that's unusual in comparison to past outbreaks.
Do you think, Thomas Boyke, that not only are these massive cutbacks to the CDC, but in 2018, President Trump disbanding the White House's pandemic response team within the National Security Council so that when he's talking about to his NSC, we got to get billions for the wall, there isn't a group pushing back in December saying, wait, we're looking at what's happening in China and we have to have a serious uptick now in dealing with what could be a pandemic.
Yeah, so I think there are a lot of lessons that no one should take from China. China did many draconian things. They had censorship. They were slow to respond to the early days of the outbreak. There are two lessons that are important to take, three lessons really, that are important to take from China. First is that speed matters. Second is the disproportionate effect of the elderly. And third is the importance to shore up medical care for when the cases start to surge and to be able to do that safely. Dismantling the NSC directorate on global health reduced our ability to respond quickly. You know, the argument from the administration is there are other officials that were taking this on. The Secretary of Health and Human Services had the lead on this issue, but it reduced the ability and the bench of people that really knew how to respond to an outbreak. And that's really important for speed. And at the end of the day, as my colleague was saying, that's the important part about responding to an epidemic is doing so effectively, reducing the spread and doing so in a timely way.
This issue of dealing with the poor, Detroit Mayor Mike Dugan announced Monday that the city would restore service to thousands of households whose water was shut off.
The governor and I sat down and said, we're going to have a solution that no resident of the city of Detroit has their water shut off for lack of funds. If you receive a shutoff notice, it's come in the mail, it's hung on your door, you can avoid your water shutoff by paying $25. And we will keep your rates at $25 a month as long as COVID-19 remains a health threat in this community.
So that's the Detroit mayor announcing, making this announcement after the city and state of Michigan came under fire last week for declining to restore service. Congressmember Rashida Tlaib, who represents a part of Detroit, tweeted the Michigan governor and lieutenant governor on Saturday, quote, no disrespect, but I'm still waiting to hear the plan that includes getting people's water back on as this disease spreads. Please don't forget poor families. They deserve protection with no access to water. We're putting them in jeopardy. This is a critical point, Dr. Marabia. I mean, for years, activists in Detroit have been saying this is an outrage. You're cutting off people's water. You keep it on for the corporations even when they don't pay their taxes, but you cut it off to the individual people. Now they're talking about turning it back on. Can you talk about the significance of this and once again how it highlights how different people are treated, but how these health issues threaten everyone?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And I think that this pandemic shows that the idea that reducing access to welfare to the poor in order to stimulate them to get jobs or to get that the immigrants become self-sufficient, etc., in order to reduce public expenses, this thing don't work. But in addition, they make us more vulnerable because the problem of access to care, access to hygiene, access to sanitation, you mentioned water, but we're going to have access to tests now. And if we have a treatment by the end of the year, access to treatment. And next year, very important, if we have a vaccine, people must have access to the vaccine too. I mean, and all these issues are key. We are like a single organism, you know, like a collective individual. And this is how we have to consider ourselves. All these anti-poor, anti-immigrant, and I would say also anti-science, because there's been this tendency to de-emphasize the role of science. I mean, in reducing the budget of CDC, that's what's happening. When they dismantled the global security team, global health security team at the National Security Council, in some ways, they reduce the influence of scientists on the executive. And this has been really a very serious component of those last year's policies. Yes.
I wanted to ask you about President Trump has said on several occasions, made comparisons to the regular flu season and the number of people who die from the flu. Could you talk about this whole issue of the mortality rate and also the rate of people who with the coronavirus are getting seriously ill or that I think it's about 10% are seriously ill, but in about 4 to 5%, the mortality rate, how that compares to the normal flu?
So this is not exactly my expertise, but I think that the president had a point to raise the issue of the flu because he mentioned the vaccine. I mean, the vaccine against the flu won't protect you against the coronavirus, but it would protect you against the flu. And we don't have to have the two. We don't want to have the two epidemics together. So reminding people that they need to get their flu shot, even under a coronavirus epidemic, that's very important, I think. And it will be true also next year. There are two epidemics. And one is a pandemic, you know, and we want people to be protected from both because both pandemics are likely to stress our healthcare system in a extremely strong way.
It was astounding to hear him say he had no idea people died of the flu. He was trying to minimize the coronavirus by saying, you know, tens of thousands of people die as a result of the flu. Astounding because his own father, his own grandfather, Friedrich Trump, died of the flu in this country.
Yeah, but you see, Amy, the role of the journal, our mission, is to bring the science
of
the American Journal of Public Health, is to bring the science, to bring the history, and to support policy. We're not watchdogs. We're not judging or giving awards on points and things like that. What we do is this. And already, you know, in November of 2018, we had this issue on the 1918 flu, you know, the great flu pandemic.
The
so-called Spanish one that killed 20 million people. But all these issues, we raised them. And now we are stressing the fact, our authors, not myself, but our authors are stressing the fact that we have to be prepared for the vaccine. And it won't happen if we are still, you know, letting anti-vax, you know, ideology spread on media.
We have to break. And when we come back, our scientists are going to stay with us, but we're going to go to a college student in Milan. The entire country of Italy is locked down. Stay with us. We'll ask her about life in the red zone.
Now that I've got you on the floor.
Let's Vote by Eric Nuri. It is Super Tuesday, too. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
We turn now to Italy, which has announced a lockdown for the entire country of 60 million people in an attempt to halt the spread of coronavirus. In an unprecedented move, Italian Prime Minister Giuseppe Conte extended regional emergency coronavirus measures, including strict travel restrictions.
I am about to sign a decree that we can describe as I stay at home. There will not be any more Zone 1 or Zone 2 in the country. It will be Italy. Italy, a protected zone. All movement across the country is to be avoided unless motivated by three specific circumstances: reason of work, reasons of necessity, or health reasons.
Credetemi, non è facile.
Believe me, it isn't easy. I am completely aware of the seriousness of these measures for the whole country, but I am forced to intervene in a more determined manner.
Italy is Europe's worst affected country, as far as we know, with Reuters reporting some 9,170 2 confirmed cases and 463 deaths on Monday. The emergency crackdown measures are the most stringent since World War II. People will only be allowed to travel for work, medical reasons, emergencies until early next month. All schools and universities are also closed until that time. Major sporting events are suspended. Passengers at Italy's airports now have to justify their reasons for traveling, as will those attempting to enter Italy. The Italian Parliament will now convene just once a week. For more, we go to the Red Zone. We're joined in Milan, Italy, by Romy Kuhl, an international student, where courses are now being taught online amidst the corona outbreak. Also with us, Thomas Boyke, director of the Global Health Program, counts on foreign relations, and Dr. Alfredo Moravia, professor of epidemiology at Queens College, City University of New York, head of the American Journal of Public Health. Romy, you're in Milan right now. Tell us what university you go to. What is the climate? What does it mean to be under total lockdown?
Hello. I am actually in Padova right now. I study in Bocconi University in Milan, but I went to my family once the whole chaos started about 2 weeks ago. This chaos has created runs on the supermarket, pasta, rice, masks and hand sanitizer to go completely out, as well as you said, that all my classes and my university campus has been closed.
And what do you do in terms day to day in terms of being able to go to the store? Or I mean, I assume that most restaurants have nobody eating in them. But in terms of the everyday necessities that you have to deal with.
Yes. So our bars and restaurants have have now created a time limit. So they close at 6 or 8 p.m. at night instead of going on. As for supermarkets, they have been open so far, but now there have been stricter rules. So if you go outside, you normally send one person in the family. And if you get stopped, you can get stopped on the street by police, and they can ask you your reason for being out of the house.
Are there shortages of food, medicine? And what does it mean if you're sick? Are you allowed to go to the doctor? Or how do you get drugs? Can you go to the hospital? Do they encourage you to go to the hospital?
Yes. So at first, there was a lot of shortages on, like I said, pasta, rice, and durable products. When I was in Milan, it was completely sold out of everything, and the supermarkets were crazy. Now it has calmed down a little bit, and everything's restocked. But again, hand sanitizer and masks are impossible to find. As for the hospital, you can, if you show that you have symptoms, serious symptoms of the coronavirus, you can be tested, but otherwise they will not test you for no reason. And they also prefer that people stay outside the hospitals to not create a very tight space and to increase the spread of the virus.
I wanted to bring Dr. Thomas Boyke back into the conversation, Professor Boyke. If you can talk about the approaches that Romy is talking about in Italy, but also not only around Europe, but in Africa, what you think are the most effective policies for countries to take? And how extreme is this? Italy on total quarantine now, not even just the north where Romy Kuhl is.
It's an extreme measure for sure. Quarantining 60 million people, it now seems like it would not be such a large number given that China had locked down our residential movement restrictions on 760 million people. But 60 million people under quarantine is a significant effort. What we have found from the early studies to come out about China's response and estimating which were more effective, it really does seem to be the social distancing policies, which can be done without restricting human rights. So the banning of public gatherings, the banning of public transport, closing of schools in affected communities. Those seem to be really the effective policies. And frankly, for the communities in the U.S. where we are starting to see community spread, the kinds of policies we should consider.
Well, for instance, here in New York, a lot of the private schools and the private universities have closed, but the public universities and the public schools remain open. You have any sense of what policymakers should be considering when they decide on these things?
So from a public health perspective, it is going to be a balance. For effective communities, it is time to start to consider, wherever possible, canceling large gatherings. We are seeing community spread. Obviously, that's a decision that's going to be made on appropriately so at the state and local level, and they should do that. But in places where we're seeing community spread, it's a strategy that people are looking at. As I understand it, the issue with the New York public schools is that there are a significant number of students that rely on these schools for lunch and for broader sources of support. That's its own problem, that schools are the only avenue for which that is available, but is part of the reason that people are taking a more balanced approach and only, as I understand it from the New York public school system, canceling school as a measure of last resort.
And the colleges like CUNY, you're a professor at Queens College, Professor Dr. Marabia, they also are not closed. But also I just wanted to ask one thing about paid sick leave. President Trump talked about different initiatives yesterday, but said they're unveiling a whole array of them today. Not clear if that will happen. He also said a million tests would be administered by last Friday. It's estimated somewhere around 4,000 have been. But CUNY hasn't closed either.
Well, I mean, it's important to do this progressively. I mean, you understand, we have to slow down the progression. So where there are risks, people are quarantined 15 days, 3 weeks, sometimes a whole city, but the progression is slowed down so that our system is not overwhelmed, okay? So it can be done in different ways.
But yeah? The issue of paid sick leave, President Trump did not mention that. What so many people, when they're told by Vice President Pence and others, just stay home if you're sick.
Absolutely. I mean, that the paid sick leave is a very important component. I think that's where we are vulnerable. I'm not so worried about the scientific aspect component of it, of our response, of our medical system, even though it's really stretched thin because of lack of resources. But I think we can handle this. The problem is our social vulnerability. The fact that even if you have the resources, people don't access. And again, this woman was talking about what's happening in Italy, people rushing on pasta and rice. It's part of the distrust in science that have been, you know, fed over all those years. I mean, if scientists had their proper role, if there were no systematic attacks against CDC, the Surgeon General, the Human and Health Services, all those agencies that are here supposed to protect the population, we would be in much better shape.
I wanted to ask Romy Kuhl, many of the universities now in Italy are going to online education. How is that working out compared to your in-face classes?
Yes, at first we had slides, and now we have YouTube videos being uploaded by our teachers giving lectures. My siblings are in a high school, and they actually have live lectures to allow interaction with the teacher and questions, which is one thing we have not gone yet, but we're heading there.
We want to thank you all for being with us. Romy Kuhl speaking to us from Padua, from northern Italy. All of Italy is on lockdown. She's an international college student there. Dr. Alfredo Marabia, head of the American Journal of Public Health. And Thomas Boyke, thanks for joining us from the Council on Foreign Relations. When we come back, prison riots in Italy, 70,000 prisoners released in Iran, New York prisoners making hand sanitizer that, well, maybe they won't be able to use themselves because of its alcohol content. We look at coronavirus in prisons and then in detention centers. Stay with us. Thank you.
Search for Peace by McCoy Tyner. The groundbreaking pianist and NEA jazz master died Friday at the age of 81. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez on this Super Tuesday 2, where people are voting in six states across the country for who could be the next president of the United States.
Well, we turn now to look at how coronavirus is affecting the world's prisons. As Italy went on lockdown, nearly 30 prisons across the country broke into riots Sunday and Monday after visitation rights were suspended in response to the outbreak. In a prison in southern Italy, a riot left at least six incarcerated people dead and caused 50 people to escape. Italy's prisons are notoriously overcrowded, and advocates are sounding the alarm that people inside have not been tested for the virus. Meanwhile, Italy's death toll continues to rise with more than 9,000 reported cases and 463 deaths. This comes as the United Nations confirmed that coronavirus had reached Iran's prisons as the number of cases there continues to soar. Iran has temporarily freed some 70,000 prisoners in response. On Monday, Iranian officials reported 595 new infections and 43 new deaths in just the past 24 hours, bringing the death toll to at least 237.
And concerns are growing about the health of at least 1 million Uyghur Muslims jailed in prison camps in western China, where at least 13 cases of coronavirus have been confirmed in the region of Xinjiang, despite a public health crisis that's left at least 3,136 dead. China has refused to close its prison camps, where conditions are reportedly dire, with rampant overcrowding, lack of sanitation. Writing for USA Today, one human rights advocate called the Uyghurs sitting ducks for coronavirus, demanding they immediately be restored to their homes. Back here in the United States, New York Governor Andrew Cuomo is facing backlash after announcing Monday New York State would respond to the growing coronavirus outbreak by producing its own hand sanitizer made by prisoners for less than a dollar an hour. Not only will prisoners be making the 75% alcohol hand sanitizer for an average of 65 cents an hour, it's unclear if they'll even be able allowed to use to protect themselves from infection, because of the level of alcohol. Items with alcohol are typically considered prisoner contraband. Well, for more on these issues, we go to Houston, Texas, where we're joined by Marshall Project reporter Carrie Blakinger. She is the publication's first formerly incarcerated reporter. Her latest piece is headlined, "When Purell is Contraband, How Do You Contain Coronavirus?" Well, why don't you answer that question for us, Carrie? Give us a lay of the land. What's happening in the United States prisons, and then talk about other places as well.
Hi, thanks for having me. In U.S. prisons, there's a lot of problems with understaffing, including both the guards and the medical staff. And even in the sort of best case scenario, the medical care is not that great in prison. And then you add on top of that that just basic disease prevention measures are either against the rules or simply impossible. And that ranges from it's usually contraband to have any sort of alcohol-based hand sanitizer. But also, it's not always possible to wash your hands regularly. Sometimes your water's out. Sometimes you're just in a situation where you don't have access to a sink for hours. You know, sometimes if you're on transport, you're literally chained to the person next to you. So it's really hard to do any sort of social distancing or to just stay clean.
Your article begins with an example of a prisoner who was punished for using hand sanitizer. Could you explain that?
Yeah, sure. There's a woman who I've spoken to for a few stories. Her name's Lauren Johnson. She is now with the ACLU of Texas. But, before she became an advocate, she did time. And when she was doing time in Texas, at one point she had gone to an annual gynecological checkup and came out and, understandably wanted to wash her hands. And there was a thing of hand sanitizer on the wall. She used it and says that, the guards started screaming at her and gave her a ticket, and she ended up losing phone privileges and rec privileges for 10 days. That's because, again, it's an alcohol-based product, and, you can't use those in prison. You can't possess them. The idea is that, there's a concern that prisoners would potentially drink it or put salt in it and separate out the alcohol. And, as a result of that, these products are typically banned.
So can you respond, Kerry, to what's happening in New York State, to Governor Cuomo announcing that it's prisoners who are going to make what he called New York clean? Now, people know around the country the shortage of Purell right now. Explain what that is and if the prisoners themselves would get to use it and what it means for prisoners to be making an essential product like that and what they're being paid.
So in New York prisons, the average pay is around 62, 63 cents an hour. And I think it's men at Great Meadow that are going to be producing this. You know, there's a lot of prison industries that are making things like license plates and stuff. But, you know, that means that we have a lot of, you know, predominantly black and brown people who are being paid less than $1 an hour. And if you don't go to work, you typically get a ticket. You get written up. You face the possibility of punishment. So, you know, I think that's sort of a dynamic we need to be aware of when we're thinking of how this plays out. But also, in the case of something like, you know, Purell or the state equivalent of Purell, it's got alcohol in it. And I see that when he announced this, Governor Cuomo said that it would be available in schools and prisons. And I've been, you know, asking the prison system since then if they were going to allow inmates to use it. Because when I was there, you know, when I did time in prison, you're not allowed to have alcohol-based hand sanitizer. And, you know, from looking at the rules that they still have online, it doesn't look like alcohol-based hand sanitizer is allowed. And, you know, so far the prison system has been ignoring my questions and questions from other reporters about whether they're going to change that and actually allow prisoners to utilize the product that they're making for less than $1 an hour.
Well, Kerry, inevitably there are going to be some incarcerated people who end up with the flu here and the coronavirus. What's been the practice in the past when we've had, for instance, Legionnaires' disease or other flu outbreaks in these prisons? How have they dealt with the inmates? Have they basically put them in solitary confinement or lockdown? How have prison authorities dealt with these issues in the past?
Well, typically when we're talking about things like swine flu, Legionnaires, mumps happens a lot in prisons, the response is to shut down visitation and to put everyone in isolation. There are probably better responses, you know, even within the realm of prisons and their, you know, understaffing and lack of medical care. You know, I mean, one possibility that I've never heard of being implemented, but might be something to consider is that, you know, some prison systems charge inmates a copay for medical care. And, you know, I don't know if waiving that, you know, would have any sort of impact. But typically prisons start with isolation and cutting off visitation.
Kerry, can you talk about how Iran responded to the coronavirus? They're being hit incredibly hard right now. A lot of the leadership has coronavirus. But they released 70,000 prisoners. Now, there's been a push in the United States to also, particularly among huge numbers of elderly and chronically ill people in prison. Can you talk about that movement and also what's happened in Italy with the uprisings in so many of the prisons there now in the midst of the coronavirus pandemic?
Well, in terms of releasing people, you know, I'm not sure what that would look like here. You know, there's different sort of ways that could work out. You could simply try to avoid pretrial detaining people and sort of reevaluate who is really a risk and who really needs to be brought into jail in the first place. But, you know, on the back end of the system, there's also the possibility of releasing people. And this is something that is largely up to parole boards in a lot of states. So, you know, it wouldn't necessarily take any sort of legislative action. In some states, it's really just that the parole board could decide, hey, we're going to release people more frequently right now. And, you know, prisoners are also a high needs medical population. They have higher than average rates of things like asthma, heart disease, you know, mental health issues, hepatitis, HIV. So this is a high risk population, and the prison population as a whole is aging. So, you know, so there's a lot of people that might be, you know, good to consider for release. In terms of what happened in Italy when you were talking about riots, I mean, that's something we could also need to at least be aware of here. I'm not going to say like there's going to be a prison riot or something, but I will say that, you know, we have a lot of facilities in a lot of different prison systems that are very understaffed. Obviously, we've seen what happens in Mississippi. There's prisons in Texas that are at 40% staffing levels. You know, the federal prisons have had ongoing staffing issues. And that's not true everywhere. There are some jails, there are some prisons that are much better staffed. But there are a number where we have these understaffing issues. And if you have like 10% of the officers not show up, like, you could have a substantial security problem.
Carrie Blakinger, we want to thank you so much for being with us, staff writer for the Marshall Project, and congratulations on the Marshall Project winning the Izzy Award out of Ithaca College and the Park Center for Independent Media for all your great work, especially winning News Inside, launched by the Marshall Project, providing reporting on criminal justice issues for prisoners with articles written by current and former prisoners. Thanks so much for being with us. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. Juan?
Well, as the world responds to the coronavirus outbreak, we look at how the Trump administration's immigration policies may put everyone at risk. For more, we go to Seattle, Washington, not far from the Sea Life Care Center in the suburb of Kirkland, which was the epicenter of the U.S. coronavirus outbreak.
In nearby Tacoma, Washington, our next guest says she saw posters in English only when she went to visit immigrants held in the Northwest Detention Center, which is run by the private prison company Geo Group. Joining us on the phone is Marumora Villaja Pando, an activist and undocumented immigrant with the group La Resistencia en Mi Gente. Last week, they issued a call for public health inspections at the Northwest Detention Center due to the danger of coronavirus inside the facility, along with other demands for how ICE should respond to the epidemic. Welcome back to Democracy Now!, Maru. Tell us what you're demanding right now.
Good morning, Amy and Juan. We are asking, first of all, the Tacoma Pierce County Health Department to ensure that there's some sort of inquiry, at least, on how is this being treated. We know because of past incidents and records that outbreaks have happened in this detention center. In the past 2 years, we've seen a lot of varicella and mumps outbreaks happening. We want to know what is being done beyond placing flyers in English about washing hands and covering cups. We're also asking to find out what are the protocols for workers. What's happening if, in case that workers do end up being ill, what will be happening then to people detained? Let me remind your audience that the building here in the Seattle area of the United States Citizenship and Immigration Service has been in lockdown, or actually shut down, for 2 weeks since March 5th, because an ICE employee that was exposed to the virus in the USCIS office decided to shut down that building. Now, that building is a building where both ICE officers and people detained at NWDC could come in and out. So how do we know that people that have been to this building has not been exposed? And we're asking ICE to stop transferings right now. We want a moratorium on transferings to NWDC or really anywhere in the nation because we're not certain that people are safe under ICE custody, nor even yet with the threat of this outbreak.
And what about your own experience in Seattle and Washington State, which has been an epicenter of the virus here in the U.S.?
Well, we are obviously looking at different ways to engage with each other. Even La Resistencia, we had an action just last Saturday, and we had to come up with different protocols. We decided to go ahead with this action because it's an outdoor activity, but a lot of activities have been canceled. We know that the state has done a really good job of trying to ensure the public that something is being done, since we definitely cannot rely on the federal government. But yet we have not seen anything in regards to people in prisons and detained. I personally don't have insurance, so I'm still trying to figure out if anything happens to me or communities like me that are not insured, what's going to happen to us? Are we going to have access to medical care? I'm also a consultant myself. I don't have paid sick leave, so what's going to happen to people like us?
And are you concerned about guards coming in with the virus, with coronavirus, Maru?
Yes, we are definitely concerned. We know that there's more people being found that they have coronavirus. It's just it's just a matter of when. Even the governor agreed that this is not, it's a matter of when. And we really worry about people in detention. You know, we know that people in detention already are at risk of even dying. Just last Sunday, another person has died under ICE custody. And then imagine if this coronavirus actually goes into the detention center. We really worry about the hundreds of people that are in there, and there's more coming. Just Sunday, March 5th.
Madhu, we're going to have to leave it there, but we will continue to cover this ever-important issue. Madhu Mota Vijayapando, activist and undocumented immigrant with La Resistencia and Mi Gente. And that does it for our broadcast. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks so much for joining us.
Good afternoon, Tuesday afternoon. It's 1 o'clock. We are broadcasting from studios at Henry Ford College. This is WHFR FM, Dearborn. This is the Malt Shop. I am not Big Daddy G. I'm a carryover from the morning program. My name is Marcy, and I'm here to help spin some stuff here for you. Get you going for the afternoon and see where it all takes us.
Up in paradise up above, if you would tell me I'm the only one that you love, life could be a dream, sweetheart.
Hello, hello again, shaboom, and hope we'll meet again.
Oh, life could be a dream, if only all my precious plans would come true. If you would let me spend my whole life loving you, life could be a dream, sweetheart.